Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Right now, it's time to welcome into the studio Andrew West. Andrew, presenter of the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National, keeping us up to date with religion in the news. Andrew, hi.
Good to be here, John.
Andrew, we can't get away from the fact that the recent weeks have been dominated by the continuing inquiry into sexual abuse, the Royal Commission inquiry, and that's dominated the headlines again this week.
It has in the last couple of weeks, principally for a major change of heart, apparently, on the part of the Archbishop of Sydney, Cardinal George Pell, soon to depart for a senior post in the Vatican. He has now told the Royal Commission, first of all via written evidence, that he now supports the Church being able to be sued by victims of clerical abuse. The Church has for many years relied on something called the Ellis Defence. That's named after John Ellis, a man whose abuse and whose suffering began when he was just 13 years old as an altar boy, and the abuse continued for many years until his early 20s. He attempted to sue the Church, but the Church was able to argue in the court successfully that the trusts that control the Church's property and its assets are not the employers of priests, and therefore these assets can't be used, can't be raided, can't be used to compensate victims of clerical abuse. Now, this has been at odds with the situation with a number of other churches for many, many years. And coming out of the Victorian inquiry into abuse down, especially in the Ballarat area, it was widely speculated that the Church would have to establish an entity that can be sued. And indeed, that is now what Cardinal Pell has said. My understanding is that he has been persuaded of this by the Truth, Justice and Healing Council, led by Francis Sullivan and its chairman, Justice Barry O'Keefe. They, I think, have persuaded him that it is simply not sustainable, nor is it ethical, for the Church to be in a position where it can financially insulate itself from victims.
And, of course, there's more to be heard on this story this coming week. The past week ended with a solicitor from Coors Chambers Westgarth, one of the firms that the Church had employed, plus Cardinal Pell's own private secretary, giving evidence which has set up the media to pay close attention to what the Cardinal himself will say this coming week, by way of explaining the position he's arrived at, which you've just outlined.
Yeah, I mean, what appears to be particularly in focus at the Commission are the, well, quite frankly, hardball tactics that some parts of the Catholic Church used to defend itself. Now, I'm not suggesting that any organisation shouldn't be able to defend itself, but
vigorously.
However, in the case of John Ellis and in the case of many, many victims, the Church had already admitted that the abuse took place. I mean, that was the point about the Ellis case. The Church had already admitted that John Ellis was a legitimate victim of clerical abuse. He had sought $100,000 in compensation. The Church was only willing to offer him $50,000. This ended up in a court case which ultimately cost the Church more than $2 million. Now, it's not for me to save the Church any money, but the point is that John Ellis had sought not even criminal damages. He had just sought to cover mainly the costs of his treatment, counselling, about $100,000. The Church decided to play hardball. They brought in a tough firm of lawyers. And this is what victims' advocates have been complaining about. Not that religious institutions won't necessarily roll over, but where they admit liability, where they admit that these people have been victims, they then present a very hardball legal defence that just seems completely at odds ethically with, you know, the mission and the witness of the Church.
Well, we shall hear more of that in the coming week. Let's move internationally now, because there are some significant international events which are largely slipping under the radar in Australia, except for programs such as yours. We've heard a lot about tensions in the Ukraine, but there's also another area that is of genuine interest, and that's Turkey. There's been a little bit in the press about the way in which the Erdogan government, which has got some sympathy among conservative elements, is moving the country towards a more hardline, influenced perhaps by Islamism position, and a breakdown that seems to have happened and a breakaway with a Muslim civil society organisation led by Fethullah Gulen called Hizmet. Can you unpack this a bit for us?
This is fascinating, and it's in greater focus because we're going to be having, just in the next few days, in the next week, local council elections, municipal elections right across Turkey.
And a series of elections following that, too.
And a series of elections following that. Interesting fact here that the Justice and Development Party, established by Erdogan to fight and win the 2002 elections, very much tilled the same ground of popular sentiment in Turkey as Fethullah Gulen's Hizmet movement. Now, the Hizmet movement is not a political organisation. You're right, it's a civil society group. And, of course, in many ways, it's a very admirable group. Its main emphasis is on education. It runs 500 schools in 100 countries. Its principal effort seems to be to get young people to excel at school. It runs basically tutorial colleges for after-school training across Turkey to make sure kids get into the professions.
And it promotes itself as offering an accommodation of Islam with modernity.
That's correct.
Modern civil society.
Yes. Where it is seen to be criticised, though, is that it also does pursue very active networks in the power centres of Turkey, not necessarily in the political parties. The Hizmet movement disputes the idea that it's infiltrated political parties, but nonetheless, there were some Gulenists who were part of the original Justice and Development Party going into parliament, but they're very strongly represented in the judiciary, in the legal fraternity, in business, very much in business. That's funds them. It's a multi-million dollar organisation raised through, money raised through successful businesses. What's happened, though, is having once been informal allies in the transformation of Turkey to what you might call not so much an Islamist state, but a culturally Muslim state, having been partners in that project, Erdogan and Fethullah Gulen have fallen out dramatically. Erdogan has been accusing the Gulen movement almost of being a fifth column, in Turkish society. Gulenists, who are well positioned within the judiciary, within the army, have been taking out prosecutions against people in the banking industry, people connected to the ruling party.
Because they're saying this isn't a political movement we're taking. We're on about civil society, and Erdogan and his people have been basically raiding the till. They've been self-seeking politicians, and we want to call them back to their mandate as builders of civil society, and hence the tension.
That is absolutely spot on, John, because remember, one of the appealing elements of the Islamist program right across the Arab world is certainly often their religious purity. I'm talking about appealing to the local people, but it's also been the idea that they're incorruptible. And Turkey had a long history of political corruption under the Kemalists, under the aggressive secularists. Now, of course, the Gulen people are saying to Erdogan, you've become as bad as the political order that you replaced. And that, as I said, has led to this rupture between these, forces that were informal allies.
The difficulty of that now appears to be that what's happening is Erdogan is moving further to the right and reaching out to conservative Islamist Muslims out in the villages and the rural countryside. And Hizmet may actually come out of this, even though one may be sympathetic to them or not, but they may come out the losers in this.
Very, very interesting parallel, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, drawn by Christopher de Balage, who's a very distinguished British writer who writes a lot about Iran and Turkey and that part of the old Asia Minor. He points out some remarkable similarities between Erdogan and the religious right in America, that they both are very strongly pro-market, pro-capitalism, but also into religious purity, personal piety. Really strong parallels there.
Let's move on to another form of piety, the Pope and the President. Now, here we have a pillar of secular piety and a pillar of religious piety.
Yes, Barack Obama and Pope Francis are due to meet later this week. Some media are actually suggesting they may be pursuing a common agenda. This comes at a very interesting time, though, for Obama, because as you and I have talked about over the past 2-3 years almost, Obama has been at war with much of the Catholic hierarchy in the United States over his healthcare mandate. And in the next couple of weeks, the challenge that some of the churches have mounted to the healthcare mandate goes in, I think, to the Supreme Court or one of the higher courts in the United States. This is at the same time that Francis will meet with Obama. Obama is not held in high regard, quite frankly, by the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in America. But it, to be honest with you, is a very politicized, hierarchy. I mean, bishops there have taken, political stances that have been really quite partisan.
That have lined themselves up with the conservative religious moral majority, the old moral majority.
Yes, but almost in a way aligned themselves with the moral agenda of the Republican Party. In the past, they have threatened to deny communion to Catholic politicians from the Democratic Party who haven't towed the line on things like abortion and same-sex marriage. But interestingly, it's reported by the Religion News Service that Obama is actually held in quite high regard in the Vatican. Officials there believe that he has a rather more layered view about the Catholic Church and its appropriate role in American society, and believes that the two issues about the healthcare mandate and freedom of conscience can be reconciled. So it's highly unlikely that the Pope will want to pursue any culture war issues with this president. What's more likely is that they're going to be looking at four areas that they have in common. The first is inequality. Now, to be frank, Obama's made this a big rhetorical issue, but his critics point out he hasn't actually done anything to tackle inequality. But that is a near obsession of this Pope. They're also going to concentrate most likely on immigration. And this is an area where the Democratic Party knows that it's got a big potential advantage with immigrants in the United States.
Citizenship laws.
Citizenship laws. But remember, the Pope has also taken a very strong position about the rights of refugees. One of the first things he did was the island of Lampedusa, south of Italy, where many refugees from North Africa have washed up, and there have been some terrible tragedies. The Pope is very interested in that. He's also likely to raise the question of human trafficking and religious freedom. Both Obama and Francis have talked about religious freedom, particularly for Christians in the Middle East. So, as I say, less culture wars and more of some of these human rights subjects that they may have in common.
So this may prove to be more of a challenge to the bishops than it is to the politicians.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, given that the bishops, are pledged to obey their Pope, but does that mean they will ease off on the culture wars? That's an open question, John.
We mentioned earlier the Ukraine. Events continue to unfold. We've seen in the last few days, despite Vladimir Putin in his aggressive speech saying, I have no interest in going to the eastern side of Ukraine, never not going to move there, words do not always betoken.
No, and the really interesting thing, though, is the position that puts the religious institutions and the churches in the Ukraine, puts them in an interesting position. They were, the priests of the Orthodox Church principally, were literally in the middle of the dispute. They were, when the riots and the demonstrations were going on in Kiev, there were priests of the Orthodox Church physically standing between the riot police and the protesters.
We should explain, too, that the church in Ukraine is complex. Mm. You have a Catholic West, an Orthodox East, and you also have a Ukrainian Rite Catholic stuck
yes.
somewhere in the middle there.
Yes, R-I-T-E. Yes, very interesting. And there's 500,000 Protestants too, and there's a growing Pentecostal movement. Yes, the churches have been quite divided in the way that they've approached the revolution in the Ukraine. There's the Greek Catholics, the Melkites, who actually have a very strong presence in the western part of the Ukraine, close to the Polish border. They are Orthodox in the way that they worship, in the style that they worship, but they are part of the worldwide Catholic communion and they pledge fealty to the Pope. They were brought into the sort of Roman or Latin allegiance when that part of the Ukraine was dominated by the Polish Empire. In Ukraine proper, you do have these competing patriarchs. The major one, the one that's recognized by all the other national Orthodox churches in the world, is the patriarch linked to Moscow. And that, in the past, has had this kind of quasi-autonomous nature to it. The Roman or the Moscow Patriarch has allowed it a fair bit of autonomy, but it's still considered an extension of Moscow. Then there's a rival patriarch in Kiev, and that is not widely recognized by the rest of the Orthodox world, but widely recognized by rank and file Ukrainians. So these now, it's not quite as simple, however, to say that the Moscow Patriarch has been on the side of the old regime and the Kiev Patriarch on the side of the revolutionaries. Not as simple as that at all. In fact, what's been happening just in the past couple of weeks have been attempts at outreach to try to bring all the sides together. And now they are talking about, maybe several years down the track, maybe being able to unite those two different patriarchs, the patriarch out of Moscow and the patriarch out of from Kiev.
And is this on the basis of preserving the integrity of Ukraine?
This is on the basis, yes, of preserving the integrity of the Ukraine. The other interesting thing, though, is, and this concerns the Jewish community down in the Crimea, the main rabbi in Crimea has actually fled to Kiev. He does not want to be part of a Ukraine nominally independent but really dominated by Russia. However, The Forward, which is a very distinguished newspaper, a Jewish newspaper in New York, is reporting that most Jews in Crimea are actually rather happy, quietly happy about the independence in inverted commas and the sort of being brought back into the Russian fold. And they may look to replace the chief rabbi of the Crimea with someone from Russia. So the Jewish community is quite split as well. The Progressive Union and the Reform Jews probably more aligned to what's happening in Kiev, and a number of, even though there are some very anti-Semitic elements in part of that provisional new government, there's also some leading Jews in that new government.
And of course, the one group that is the minority as ever are the Tatars.
Absolutely. And
their Muslim tradition does not fit well in that corner.
And they have felt under increasing pressure. National Public Radio reported only in the last few days, on Friday, I think, that the Tatars were speaking of an oppression that they believe could rival World War II.
The other irony that surrounds all of this, we must move on, is that, of course, when you use the word Kiev, historically, you're talking about the origins of the Rus and Kiev. So there's much more to be said on this topic over the next few months. We'll finish with an acknowledgement of the passing of somebody once regarded as the most dangerous man in Britain.
Yes, Tony Benn, always considered a radical firebrand of the left, a legendary Labour MP, 50 years in the Parliament, I think 1952 to 2002, 2001, almost 50 years in the Parliament. Now, of course, John, you did the most wonderful interview with Tony Benn back in 2003. You were a modest man, so it requires me to say that Tony Benn said that it was the best, most probing, enlightening interview that he'd done. But the interesting thing about Tony Benn and why we're mentioning him is, despite his status and his reputation as a firebrand of the left, he also attributed his both passion and ideology and values to Christianity, because he came out of the dissenting religious tradition in the United Kingdom. It was his grandfather or great-grandfather, I think, who was a Congregationalist minister, and his mother, I think, was a Congregationalist lay leader.
And he grew up under the influence of Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who lived just almost next door.
He did, but John, as I recall in that interview with you, he said, yes, while it was, we were in that proximity to the famous Webbs, the intellectual tradition of the Fabians was not as influential on him as the dissenting religious tradition of Methodism and of Congregationalism. And he said it was what gave him his passion, what gave him that passion that he brought to politics for five decades was the kind of tub-thumping oratory that he found in the church. And his late father used to say to him, dare to be Daniel, the story of Daniel in the lion's den, dare to go up against hostile forces, dare to be brave.
It was an old Sunday school hymn. Andrew, if you'd grown up in the dissenting traditions, you would recognise it. Dare to be a Daniel, dare to stand alone, dare to have a purpose firm, and dare to make it known.
Absolutely. And, John, you're going to have a reminiscence of Tony Benn. I'm going to look forward to that.
Tony Benn, coming up a little later in the program. Andrew West, thank you very much for joining us once again on Sunday Night. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.